grown up where I did, in it was a classic urban jungle, and I didn't even know that marine biology was a thing. I didn't know you could become a marine biologist. And when I did find out that, years and years later, it was just a revelation, really.
It's episode 33 of Dive in the Podcast with special guest Dr. Lauren Smith. Welcome to Dive in the Podcast, your favorite podcast about all types of diving, scuba tech, freediving, and more. We cover it all. Every week on Monday, we post new episodes filled with diving news, interesting dive topics, ocean advocacy, and much more. Hi, everybody. I'm Justin.
I'm Nick.
I'm Amit.
And I'm April.
We're the hosts of Dive in the Podcast. Tonight, we're speaking to Dr. Lauren Smith. She's a scuba diver, freediver, marine biologist, coastal ecologist, and underwater photographer based in Scotland who is passionate about elasmobranch conservation and research. So I was thinking about last week's episode and all the positive vibes from that, especially with the Dan stories when he was chatting with you, Nick, and everybody coming together and all just talking about the positive things about being in the water. That was pretty good storyline we had for the episode there.
We should try to line up like that more often, I guess. It was good. Did anyone notice that Nick wasn't actually there?
I don't know. I didn't get any direct feedback, but I've kind of been incognito a little bit. So maybe maybe some people have noticed and just hadn't run into me yet to tell me that.
To tell you.
Well, I thought you did a pretty good job, Justin.
Yeah, it was a fun interview to do.
So, Nick, you like to hold your breath.
Occasionally.
Occasionally, yeah.
I've been known to free dive from time to time. Even
where are you going with this, Justin?
Free dives? What?
Yeah. Yeah. Did you know that they've restarted the, I don't know, what seems to be like multi-decade long production of the follow-up to the Avatar movie?
This is Avatar 2?
Avatar 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, I think. Actually, this is specifically Avatar 2. I'm just being sarcastic because I believe they're recording like all of the new Avatars all at once.
And, oh, wow.
They're coming out with like 6 of them and filming them all at the same time?
Sorry, I shouldn't have said that. I was just being sarcastic because I think they are doing 3, maybe 4. I forget how many.
You realize James Cameron will never come on the show now that you've done that. Like, you just ruined our chances.
It's okay. It's okay. I've listened to his TED Talk.
You've heard everything he has to say.
Yeah. So now that they've started production back up in New Zealand for Avatar 2, Kate Winslet had some photos released of her underwater in this interesting getup with like a big cape and stuff behind her. It'll be interesting to see how that comes out underwater. But what everyone's amazed at is her 7 minute and 14 second breath holds.
That's
a very decent, very solid seconds. Breath hold. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So, Nick, what's your thoughts there? Like, how does a person hold their breath for that long, man? That seems insane to a non-freediving type person like myself.
I mean, it's not horribly far from the world record, but it's also not close either. I mean, it's mostly learning technique and just practicing, and just like anything, any sport, right? You train for it. Now, it's totally doable. I think the world record for at least the men's is something like 11 minutes or something.
Also, they had Performance Freediving International founder there, Kirk Crack. I know during the pandemic shutdown, I watched some stuff he did on Facebook and technical freediving and talking about specific gas breathing for the specific depth you're diving, which is kind of interesting, right?
Yeah, it's interesting because generally, I think if you breathe up oxygen, like the effect itself are like reasonably short lived. So it's not like you can like spend like, a you know, like 2 days on oxygen and then it's just going to like... Not that you would be able to because of the toxicity, but the effects can be short-lived. So I think if you breathe up oxygen or some gas mixture just before you dive, then there's a huge benefit to it. But I think he was also talking about like, you know, like in situations like this with productions, right? It's got a huge applications for situations where people have to be underwater to perform some sort of act or something, but it's not necessarily about going deep, right?
Right. Yeah, I guess just to allow them to perform better or be safer and do all those things. It's definitely interesting. If you have a chance, I'd check into Kirk Crack. They've got a link to his bio in the article I was reading, and his bio's kind of wild. It's probably more interesting than Avatar 2.
Wow.
I can't believe Avatar.
Yeah, Justin. I'll
watch it. I'll definitely watch it.
This guy he went to the Mariana Trench, man. Like he does movies just to fund his diving.
I'm not digging on James Cameron. I was actually, all I was saying is Kirk Crack's bio is like I don't know, 15 pages long. It's pretty interesting. That's what I was saying.
Right. Yeah, don't load stuff.
It's more interesting than Avatar.
I think that's what you did say. Yes, so.
But not as long as Avatar.
Okay.
Backing yourselves into corners tonight, Justin.
All right, forget it. Yeah. I'm done. Go to Avatar 2. Read up on Kirk Crack. Breathhold is cool. And there's
everything is awesome.
Everything is awesome.
I was going to tell Amit that the world record is 902 for women's static apnea.
Oh, wow. So she's actually not that far off, really.
Yeah, that's a long time, but man. I got
to
tell
it's,
you.
It's a pretty big jump from 7 to 9. It doesn't seem
true.
That.
I guess when you think about seconds, it is quite far. I think I have the worst in the world women's breath hold. So, I mean, she could, on the spectrum, I'm just the bottom of it.
Yeah, I'm going to give her some props on that because I'm going to assume that the reason that she started freediving was not because she wanted to be a freediver, but to shoot this movie. So would I be off base by saying that she must have taken it seriously to get to 7 minutes? Like, because that seems like craziness to me. Like, you know, I'd be lucky if I get a minute out of that on a breath hold, but you know, recognizing I don't have any training whatsoever, it seems like you'd have to take it seriously to get up to 7 minutes. And
you definitely have to apply yourself. There's no doubt. You do have to do some training. You don't work up to 7 minutes, you know, without any training, but it's doable. Yeah.
I think it's along the same lines as these actors who get super built and cut and all that for these roles. And sometimes you got to become a muscle bound Hulk, and sometimes you got to become a world class freediver.
Yeah, I guess that's a fair analogy. Yeah, fair analogy.
Yeah.
So, Nick, earlier on, you had a chance to chat with Dr. Lauren Smith. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I actually went to undergrad at the University of Plymouth with Lauren, and I actually hadn't really talked to her in years and years and years, even though we kind of kept in touch over social media. So it was actually good to sit down and have a chat with her and catch up to all the things she's done. She's been quite successful in where she's wanted to go with her research and her diving. And also really cool where she talks about an old club she resurrected called the Amphibians Club, which is a really cool story. So I hope people enjoy listening to the interview. Let's dive in. Lauren, can you tell us where you're from and how do you describe what you do for a living?
I'm from the UK and I was born in the middle of England, as far away from the ocean as you can get in the UK. But then I moved to Plymouth to do my undergrad. And after then, I ended up at Aberdeen in Scotland. So I've been living in Scotland for quite a number of years now. And up here, I'm a shark biologist and coastal ecologist. So I kind of work in as many elasmobranch-related projects as I can with my work, but also I'm quite interested in the overall habitat, protection of different habitats, and in that I do a lot of diving, and sort of diving's a thread that has kind of cropped up throughout jobs that I have done that are related to marine biology in general, really.
So what was your first memory of the ocean?
Ooh, first memory of the ocean is, it's got to be trips away with my family. And it's probably a bit of a cliche, really, to say this, but I used to love rock pooling as a kid. You know, you get your little net and you're searching underneath the little rocks for any crabs or little shrimps and things that you might find. And that's what I remember. And I did that from, well, as soon as I could sort of walk and support myself by the side of a rock pool, I guess, without risk of face planting in and my parents watching over me. So I did that, and we went on little holidays or day trips to the coast, and that really just sticks in my mind. The shark angle didn't come for many, many years after, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I didn't even realize, you know.
Why did you want to become a marine biologist?
I just loved the ocean. I loved finding out everything about it. It's like another world that not everybody gets to see underneath the ocean. You know, when you're at the coast, you look across and it's just looks like this surface with sort of all unknown things underneath the surface, really, that just need to be having a closer look at. And I think it just sort of gave a window into that world and made me think, right, okay, there's so much stuff there to learn and to find out about, and how everything interacts with other aspects of the planet as well. It was just sort of finding out how everything was linked in as well with the ocean, that really captivated me, I think.
Yeah, but you didn't start diving until university, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It was down at Plymouth University, and in the first year, I think it wasn't quite part of the course that they offered it, but it was sort of a thing that went alongside in parallel. And they said, you know, if you want to learn to dive, and it was with BZAC that they had the club with. So I learned to dive then. So yeah, I would have been 18 or so. And it was just, I mean, it was just hilarious, to be honest, because none of the suits fitted, you know. It was a classic. It was like I was put in this sort of oversized kind of jumpsuit, sort of Farmer John style wetsuit. And it was always the case that the sleeves were like hanging low. So, you know, that first entry, it was fine when we were doing swimming pool stuff, of course, like no problems there. But that minute I remember we went off of a boat dive, and just to top it off, I was seasick as well. So you can imagine, you're just doing your qualifying open water dives. And I, you know, I was sick off the side of the boat. And when I went in the water, the like pretty cold water flooded in. Despite all that, I carried on, which is, I think, a testament to itself, to be honest. But things did get better, and I discovered seasickness tablets. So there was a lot of improvement there. But I learnt there with BZAC, and have always done sort of diving on and off kind of since. But it's been in just more recent years that I've really incorporated it, I think, into my life a lot. More, be it with job or just for fun dives, and just really, really enjoying being in the ocean from it.
You know, that's good on you, because, you know, I learned to dive in the Caribbean, and I'm always in awe that people that stick with it when they're learning to dive in cold water, let alone when they're seasick. So that's awesome. But, you know, all hardships of the initial dive aside, what was that first encounter with being able to breathe in the water?
Yeah, it was absolutely fantastic. I mean, obviously all the training that's done in the swimming pool prepares you to a certain amount, but it's, you know, I'll never forget that actual feeling of being in the sea. It's, you know, you're in a completely different realm. You're just getting to see things that you would never normally see. I mean, okay, you can go to an aquarium or whatever, but you just don't have that. It's such an immersive experience, and it gives you the ability to just spend a bit of time down there in another world, and you're getting to look at species, and whether, you know, you start doing photography or whatever, and you can really kind of get into that and actually learn more about the environment that you're in. And I mean, perhaps not for everyone, but for me, being a part and being able to go and visit that world is key to kind of my understanding of everything as well, really, to do with, you know, marine biology and how everything relates to each other.
Yeah. Diving obviously forms part of your identity, but I know you're also passionate about sharks, and that's something you did your PhD on. Why sharks, and what did your doctorate tell you about sharks?
Sharks. Well, originally I started getting, I'd say, obsessed with sharks. And that was actually the last year of Plymouth Uni, and we were given an assignment, and we had to look at, it was something about the conservation status of a highly migratory species, I think, and you could pick whatever migratory species you wanted. And I remember going away and thinking about this, and I started looking up aspects of different species and just got really drawn in by the blue shark. So the more I'd started reading about the blue shark, so one of the, you know, highestly migratory species of shark that there is, but also one of the most fished. And at the time, it was just kind of, data was just more starting to come in about shark finning at the time. So before, you know, I hadn't even heard of shark finning. And so there was that kind of conservation aspect that I started really having my eyes open to, as well as the biology and different characteristics of the blue sharks. And I remember I wrote that essay, and then that just sparked something, really, and I just wanted to learn more and more about different types of sharks. I wanted to know what shark species were in our waters. I wanted to know where there was like shark hotspots, you know, where could you swim with them, where could you dive with them, and all the different aspects of sharks. I just wanted to know as much as I could about them, and it just really gripped me. So for my PhD, I was looking at how sharks know what depth they're at in the ocean, and also how do they utilize different depths. So I was looking at the lemon shark. This is where I got to go away from Scotland for a while and got to indulge myself in the Bahamas. So that was lemon sharks, primarily out there in Bimini, where there's the world-famous Bimini Shark Lab out there. So getting to spend a few months tracking sharks, juvenile sharks, seeing do they stay higher up in the water column? Do they spend any time diving deeper down? Is this related to tides? Is it related to potential predators, time of the day, different things like that, temperature? And it was just trying to understand how a shark in a way lives in its environment. What does it actually utilize in terms of the depth that it's got? Because, you know, ultimately a shark, it can go pretty much wherever it wants in the water column, but why would it choose to be in a certain level [S2] Sure. [S1] Of water column? And so some of that, you know, it's to do with predation, it's to do with optimum temperature, which helps the metabolism optimize. And I also looked at how sharks can actually sense what depth they're at. Huh. And we think that this is to do with the inner ear. So sharks don't have a swim bladder, primarily because for buoyancy, they use their enormous livers and the liver oil. And that's how they tend to control their buoyancy more. Whereas most bony fish have this sort of inflatable swim bladder. But the swim bladder is also used for pressure detection changes. So that can actually sense what depth that the fish is at. So without sharks having that organ, how do they, you know, regulate depth? How do they know what depth they're at? So we looked at other species originally who also would use depth differently, but didn't have a swim bladder. So that we actually looked at crabs. And with crabs, they use their vestibular system, which is basically sort of, they have a mechanism whereby they can sense using tiny little hair cells the different pressures. And we thought, well, maybe could that be carried over to other species? And we looked at that model in sharks as well, so primarily looking within the inner ear. And they also have little hair-like systems, basically, that although we're not 100% sure whether that works, it's looking quite likely that they can certainly sense the pressure changes that way. So it could be that way that they're actually able to sense what pressure they're at, and then they're sort of basing their decisions or behavioral decisions or biological decisions, so where they're going to go and feed, and they know they're relating those pressures to different aspects of what they're doing basically with their lives. So that was my PhD, and some of it was, as I say, out in the Bahamas, some of it was in the aquarium, and some of it was in the lab trying to understand the overall mechanism. So it was quite a good feel for many different aspects of sharks and being able to look at different things. So we came out with, it was pretty interesting, not perhaps a absolutely conclusive answer, but certainly lots of interesting information along the way.
I guess if you're a pelagic species like a shark, it's good to know where you're at in the water column, right?
Absolutely. One way or another. Useful. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. For a lot of people, and a lot of divers too, I can think of one of the co-hosts of the podcast who has a fear of sharks. You know, that it drives a lot of marine biologists a little crazy and probably doesn't help much with conservation. Are those fears misplaced, or are they founded in something?
I can understand why when you see a lot of media headlines and certain films come to mind that, you know, paint the shark as this absolute ultimate killing machine that's going to just, you know, eviscerate anything that's in its path. But it's certainly, you know, at the end of the day, sharks are wild animals. So I don't really go for the whole, let's make them all fluffy and completely, you know, they're not going to hurt anyone. They're predators. Some plankton feeders, but, you know, overall quite a few species will be predators. And when you go into the water, you're in their environment. So I always think a healthy level of respect goes a long way. That said, you know, not part of their diet. We're certainly not something that they would go to predate on. And a lot of incidences where there have been shark bites, some of those unfortunately have, you know, turned out to be fatal. There's always sort of tends to be a link with something else going on. So sometimes it's dusk, for example. Folk have gone out swimming or surfing and it's dusk, and that's, you know, if there's a population of, let's say, bull sharks, is quite a good example in places, and tiger sharks that will actually feed at dawn and dusk. So, you know, it's their time when they're going out to predate. If the water's churned up, if they're, you know, not perhaps utilizing all their senses, if they haven't got good visibility, then they might go and do a test bite, basically, which ultimately a test bite can be a little unfortunate, you know, when you've got as many teeth as they have. So that's why we end up with a few of these incidences. But on the whole, you know, you are far more likely to have some sort of incident with a cow. Or, you know, what is like, it's something like a vending machine. You're more likely to have a vending machine kill you than a shark, which, well, brings all sorts of images to mind. But yeah, so, you know, largely unfounded, but it is about kind of making sensible decisions, I also think, you know, when you're in the ocean, you know, you don't need to go up and poke a shark just to see how it's going to react. give it a healthy level of respect, and, you know, it'll just go about its business, to be honest. And I spent quite a lot of time in the water with different species of shark. So oceanic white tips is probably a good example, because they have quite the hysteria, potentially, you could say, around them. They are confident sharks. They, you know, when you're diving, you're in open ocean. They are not afraid to come up in your face. They will bump your camera, that kind of thing. So, you know, you have to watch what you're doing. But I've never felt threatened when I've been in the water. I've never had a shark show aggressive behavior. And mind you, all the sort of shark diving and the operators as well, you know, they've all been very good in what they do. And, you know, if you sort of pay attention to the briefs and you kind of really take on board what they're saying, then you should have no problem at all, really.
I really like your balanced approach, because I'm always fascinated by how some people interact with sharks in ways that we would never consider interacting with lions or bears, right? That would never cross our minds. But yet, some other things are considered acceptable. So that's kind of maybe the other extreme. Well, thanks for that. Maybe that'll put Amit, our co-host, a bit at ease, because we have, I don't know if you've been following sort of the growth and interest in great whites here on the Atlantic coast of Canada. Okay. So we have there's a group of people from the States. They come out every season and they live tag great whites, and there's an app you can follow them, so they ping really close to shore. Like, they've been tagging some really big sharks within like sight of land, some great whites, and it's unnerving for some people. what kind of sharks do you find in Scotland?
So we have the pretty enormous seasonal visitor of the basking shark.
Nice.
So basking shark, second largest shark, and filter feeder plankton. So yeah, they're predominantly on the west coast of Scotland. They come up, and sometimes around into the northeast. I have seen them just along the coast where I live in the northeast. So we get those as seasonal visitors. But other than that, I mean, if you're diving, then the small spotted cat shark is one that you might expect to find. So we also call them dogfish, but yes. Dogfish and cat sharks is so confusing. And then there's another shark that actually is called a dogfish, the spiny dogfish, so it's all kinds of chaos there. But I love the cat sharks. You know, they're just these, they're pretty small, like, you know, 1 meter kind of tops, is mostly tail as well, you know, and they just rest on the bottom and they hang out. And, you know, on a dive, sometimes if you come across them, they will just pose there and they'll just lie there. They're happy to just check you out, and you're, you know, trying to get photos of them and whatever, and they just sort of observe you and let you be on your way. And it's the cat sharks that we also find their egg cases wrapped around the kelp and the seaweed. So that I love finding egg cases on a dive. So if you're some going into like a kelp forest area, and at the base, you know, that's where they wrap their egg cases around. So it's really cool, because sometimes you can actually see the little embryos developing inside, which is, yeah, it's really great. I love that.
They're quite pretty sharks too, right?
They are a little underrated, I always think, but they're very cute and they're great to dive with. So there's those. And then we have on the west coast, there is things like spiny dogfish. They come into the sea locks quite a lot. There's tope. And then we also have the blue shark. Well, blue shark comes up as a seasonal visitor. They're mostly kind of coming up of Cornwall way, but there is reports of them off of the west coast of Scotland. I have yet to see them myself off Scotland, I have to say. So I haven't seen those yet in the Scottish waters, but are reported to be there. We get poor beagle sharks. So poor beagles are reasonably closely related to great whites. And these guys, like, not often seen inshore in coastal areas, but quite often further out to sea off of the oil rigs or off of vessels, quite often they'll actually see poor beagles and they'll film them or they'll catch them on sort of underwater recorders, you know, and do a double glance because they do kind of look, you know, great whitish or even they also kind of look like a short fin mako as well. But there's a few telltale signs on them. So they've got like a white patch on the their trailing edge of their first dorsal on poor beagles. And that's just a classic kind of indicator that it's a poor beagle and not anything else. So those, but I mean, they, for example, they were heavily fished in the 1980s. There was massive fisheries and they almost, well, you know, made a heavy dent in the population anyway. I didn't quite fish them out, but, you know, they took a big impact, but less so now. You don't see those fisheries like they were used to. And I think the populations are starting to make a bit of a comeback, which is great. But yeah, I mean, other than those, we also get skates in our waters. So when I say skate, I mean what is also commonly known as rays, but rays and skates. So skates lay cases, whereas rays are live birth. So even though the common name is often given like as a ray, it's actually a skate. But that's just me being pedantic. To be honest, well, I've got a little thing about that. It bugs me. But yeah, so we've got things like thornbacks in our waters and cuckoos. And the flapper skate, which is something that I've been working on recently as well, looking at those because they're critically endangered species. And to be honest, we don't know an awful lot about them. It's only been a few years since they were actually identified as their own unique species as well, because they were before they were clumped together with the blue skate. So just goes to show actually off our waters that we've got a lot to actually learn about many species, including the elasmobranx.
Yeah, it always fascinates me how, you know, how much we know about the oceans, but in truth, how little we know, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And always playing catch up with trying to, you know, learn things before they're gone. It certainly sounds like Scotland is a super fascinating place to come diving. Maybe when this is all over, I'll definitely add that to my travel list now that I've got cold water experience.
Absolutely. I'd definitely like to take you on some dives over here. That'd be great.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to make that a priority. So just changing maybe direction a little bit. So you didn't really fit the classic, you know, sort of academic mold of doing a PhD and, you know, delving into the ivory tower of research. But so diving features in your work. So what kind of work do you do now and how does diving fit in there?
After I finished my PhD, I sort of went off on a tangent and I was looking at the shark immune system for a while. I was researching that and I've kind of got a bit of a habit of pinging about on different types of shark biology and different aspects of that, really. But yeah, I kind of started diving more with my work when I worked for a local species aquarium a good few years back now. And that's when diving again really became kind of a part of what I do. So I was fortunate enough in that role to be able to dive, you know, several times a week with local species and just outside the aquarium as well as inside the aquarium tanks as well. And now I'm doing as much as I can. So I work on little projects, research projects, basically, some collaborative ones with people in the UK, but then also in South Africa and different places. And it's a sort of just like small research projects, trying to find out as much as we can, usually shark based. I'm also working on marine pollution, so plastic pollution on the beaches around the northeast as well. So that kind of feeds in there, and just small projects with little grants to fund various parts and answering questions as much as I can. So I can't really seem to get away from that question in nature. So that's, I guess that's part of the academia, but not within the university walls, as it were. So it's great. I mean, we get a lot of help as well. So quite often it's like citizen science projects with a lot of keen people. And a lot of people, I think the thing about divers is they've got a lot of experience of what they have seen, but sometimes it just doesn't go reported. You know, it's maybe on, you know, social media, it's on Facebook pages with photos and stuff attached. But actually, in terms of then kind of translating that into the science side of things, there's a bit of a disconnect there. So it's actually quite nice. And in some ways, I'm trying to bridge that gap, I guess. Mm-hmm. I want science to be accessible to people to members of the public. I don't want science just to be in journals, you know, that only a certain, perhaps academia end up actually accessing ultimately, people in academia end up accessing, but to have that, you know, a bit more of a broad sweeping approach and actually get that information out there, have that help with sort of education as well, and yeah, kind of bridge that gap and get everybody talking about marine biology and how cool the science is.
That's awesome that you're able to combine, you know, diving and science and keep at it, right? I do have a question for you, and again, related to diving, obviously, but can you tell us a little bit about the Amphibians Club? I've seen you post about that, and it seems super fascinating. What is it? And yes, for those of us not familiar.
Yes, I can actually. Yes, it is brilliant, and it's a great story. So I was down at a dive meetup in Birmingham, went back down from Scotland, down to Birmingham. And around there, I was sort of perusing the different stalls and things. And I was looking at various aspects of books. There was the Historical Dive Society was there, and I was picking up, there was a few gems there that I was picking up to buy. And I got chatting to a chap there, and he mentioned this guy called Ivor Howitt. And he said, oh, you know, there's a guy called Ivor Howitt, and because we'd been speaking about where I lived, I was just outside Aberdeen, and he said, oh, he's linked to Aberdeen. He used to have a little club running there, like, you know, years and years and years ago. And it was the first recreational diving club that was formed in the UK. So I said, all right. And he gave me a link, I think it was, to go and check out. And ultimately, I saw Ivor Howitt's name come up, and I got hold of his email address. And so I pinged an email off, and so went this, so started this friendship that I now have with Ivor. Ivor is now 93, and wow, he lives in New Zealand. He's absolutely fantastic, and he's very good on email, fortunately, so we can correspond pretty well. And he started telling me, because I was sort of seeing the areas of coast that he used to be so familiar with, that he was diving, I think it just sparked in him, you know, something as well. So he started explaining to me, and this was just coming out of the war, and he set up with his friends a little club called the Amphibians Club. So it was diving and also mountaineering primarily, so hiking the hills nearby. And the scuba part of it was just fantastic. So this was at a time when there was no recreational gear available, you know, you couldn't buy any of it. He was modifying all sorts to basically create recreational scuba gear. I mean, you know, there's bedpans, there's all sorts. They had like bicycle pumps, and they would be pumping air, and by like kind of given someone was in like sort of a well, you know, testing out some gear, and the guy was topside pumping like an old bicycle pump to pump air down to them. And what they did was just absolutely inspirational for the time, you know, and they came up with all this different gear. And to sort of cut a long story short, more recreational gear did start to come onto the market years down the line. But we are talking, this he started in 1947.
Wow.
And I think it was 1947 or 1948, he launched his little Amphibians Club. And they would go dive in and test equipment. I mean, no wetsuits or anything like that. How they didn't freeze to death. I mean, they were diving in the winter. I mean, good grief, you know, absolutely incredible. And then after that, he actually went out to Australia, and he wanted to go out there because, you know, his dream, he'd grown up looking at like William Beebe and things like that. And he wanted to go out and dive the Great Barrier Reef. So he went out to Australia, and then, you know, of course, he wanted to photograph it. So they actually built their own underwater housings. You know, they were welding things together. They were using cooking pots. Again, just incredible. And he photographed the Great Barrier Reef, and all on film. I mean, camera. I mean, I'd be lost these days, you know, without working in digital. But anyway, and he did that. And then eventually he moved to New Zealand and so on, really. But it was a time where he was just absolutely doing incredible things, you know, in terms of recreational scuba diving. And it was just a fantastic story. So now I'm just kind of carrying on his sort of Amphibians Club legacy. So it's just all it is. It's what he had. It's just a bunch of friends that we go diving, and you know, and we go mountain climbing, and you know, we fall under the umbrella of the Amphibians Club, really. But it's just so nice to speak to Ivor about how things were and hear him explain about how he tried to, you know, put this together or that together, and just absolutely incredible sort of listening to how that used to be.
That's super awesome. I remember you writing an article by that. Is that available for listeners? Is that available online?
It is, yeah. Well, it came out in Diver magazine. It might be available online, but I can send a link through.
Okay. We'll add that to the show notes. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Yeah.
Wow, thanks. That is super fascinating. Just watching the article that you had sent me a copy of and watching some of the photos of the underwater housings at the time. Wow, that is awesome. We're almost up for time, so I'm going to ask you the question that we normally ask everyone at the end. What keeps you diving?
What keeps me diving? Oh, that's actually quite a good question, isn't it, really? Part of it is the hope of, or rather, wonder of what you're going to see next time. Am I going to see something else? And the rest of it is just an absolute break from the terrestrial world. So it's, a chance to be able to get away from gravity for a while and everything that's included, to hear just when I'm underwater and I can, you know, I'm just hearing the ocean around me and sort of experiencing that in real time. Yeah,
leaving the surface behind these days is actually a bit of a bonus, right?
Absolutely.
Before you go, where can people find your adventures online? I know you have an Instagram and maybe a website.
Yeah, so that's at Saltwater Life UK. So yeah, that's on Instagram and on Twitter as well. And my website is saltwaterlife.co.uk. So that's kind of stuff about sharks and different little bits of research projects as well.
Awesome. Pretty easy to find. And we'll add those links to our show notes when the episode comes out.
Perfect. Thank you.
Lauren, thank you so much for sharing your time and your passion. It's been such a great pleasure catching up with you after all these years. And it's wonderful to see you still have all that energy and that enthusiasm. So it's really awesome.
Likewise, Nick. Thank you so much for having me on. And it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure catching up. And it's always a pleasure to speak about diving and sharks anyway. So
yeah, for sure.
Well, another great interview, Nick. Definitely called out Amit, though.
Yeah, man, what's up with that? Like, I'm sitting there listening to the interview, I'm like, whoa, way to throw a guy under a bus or something.
Or under a shark, as it may be.
Under a shark, I like that one.
That's right, yeah, turn him into chum.
I want Amit to come to appreciate and like sharks and not fear them.
Okay, we got to be clear. So I think like where I'm at is that I think, you know.
No, you can't explain your way out of this one.
The term, I think, is a healthy respect for sharks, I would call it. I mean, I was in the Bahamas. I was in the water with sharks probably on at least 6 or 7 dives, and, you know, did one of those giant, like, shark feed things there with the big chumsicle. So we had about 15 or 20 sharks buzzing around our head, and I had a couple of them zipping across me, you know, to the point where I could rub their bellies if I lifted a hand up. So I won't say that I'm scared of them, but I respect the fact that like one of us belongs in that environment and the other does not. And so I think, you know, in the grand scheme of thing, I would put it as a healthy respect with a touch of fear in there for sure. When we start talking about these, what is it, the 20-foot great whites that are kicking around here sometimes, yeah. That crosses my mind and I'm like, whoa, okay, I don't need to see one of them.
Well, it was interesting to hear Lauren talk about, you know, different approaches that people have to sharks. And, you know, she doesn't necessarily agree with all the interactions that are out there. So she does echo a little bit what you're saying as well.
Yeah.
But you know what struck me about the interview too? All the diversity of stuff that she gets access to experience diving in Scotland. Just the diversity of sharks and the marine life that they have. And yeah, that really makes me want to go to Scotland. And it makes like diving just off the shore here in Nova Scotia a little bit more of a desert, I suppose, in terms of diversity.
Yeah, I was shocked at it, man, when I heard her talking about all the different species of, you know, of sharks that are kicking around there. And, you know, then I saw on her Twitter site, she has what looks to be like a little purple octopus in her hand or something here. I'm not sure what exactly that is. But yeah, the fact that I would have never ever thought that going to Scotland to go diving would have given you that kind of level of biodiversity.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back with more from Diving the Podcast. Hi,
Hi everyone, I just wanted to take a second to thank our sponsor, Torpedo Rays Scuba. Torpedo Rays is a local dive shop in Nova Scotia. If you're not in Nova Scotia, that's okay. They've got a wonderful website, torpedorays.com, TORPEDORAYS.com. All of the scuba gear you could ever need is there. If you can't find it, give Jason a call, 902-481-0444, and he'll be happy to help you out. In these challenging times, it's always great to shop local. Don't go to a huge big box. Help support your local dive shop. Buy something you've had your eye on. Excellent time to make a good deal. Buy a gift certificate to use later. Whatever the case may be, Torpedo Rays and torpedorays.com will be there for you. Once again, their number is 902-481-0444 or torpedorays.com.
All right, welcome back to Dive in the Podcast. Thanks for sticking with us. Earlier, we spoke with Dr. Lauren Smith, and now we're going to chat with Amit about technical diving. So, Amit, take it away.
All right. So, DecoStop, week two. This week, I wanted to cover sort of a very broad overview about some of the historical events that enable us now to be weekend warriors so that later on, we can dive in more deeply to individual components of tech diving. So to the folks listening, if there is something that sparked an interest or sparks an interest and that you wanted to hear more about, then definitely please do shoot us a message and I'll see if I can work that into some of the future episodes. So on with it then. The history. In 1667-ish, an Irish physicist by the name of Robert Boyle was running some experiments in a pressure chamber, observing what happened to snakes during pressure changes. I don't know that this would pass ethics board reviews today, but in any event, I think he just didn't particularly care, or maybe they just didn't see it the same way that they would today. Different world back then. So in one instance, he reduced the pressure that the snake was in, and he observed that it was in a good amount of discomfort, later noting that a bubble had formed in the snake's eye that wasn't there, of course, when he started this experiment. And it was thought that this was the first record of decompression illness. At the time, though, no one could really explain what that was. So incidentally, for the folks listening, he's also the guy that derived Boyle's Law. So if you're a diver and you haven't heard about that, the relationship between changes in volume and pressure, maybe give it a quick Google search. So later on in the mid-1800s, a guy named Colonel William Paisley was sending salvage divers to depths of about 20 meters or 65 feet for hours at a time. And of course, these guys came out with unusual aches and pains that they termed the mysterious malady because nobody knew why this was happening. This was also seen in bridge construction in France and England, where caissons, which are large pressurized dry boxes, were used to construct bridge footings and tunnels below the waterline. One observation was that the symptoms disappeared when the workers returned to the pressurized caisson. In 1870, though, during the construction of the Brooklyn Bridge, they saw, I guess, a more severe version of this that prevented people from standing up straight when they came out and basically enter the term the bends. But you know, the key thing here was that even though this was happening, nobody really understood why it was happening until we see this French physiologist, Paul Blurt, enter the scene. He was doing experiments roughly around the same time, and he was a big contributor to really unraveling this mystery. So Blurt came up with a number of things, and I'm just going to list them off real fast here, kind of in rapid fire. But he found out that altering ambient pressures resulted in corresponding changes to tissue gases. He noticed that too much oxygen in the blood was toxic and that too little could cause oxygen deprivation. Decreasing ambient pressure caused bubbles to form in tissues, which then caused the bends, and that the bubbles consisted of nitrogen gas. That was a key factor as well. He determined that long exposures with rapid depressurization caused terrible side effects, while minimal exposures with slow depressurization caused little to no effects. So he was also the first person to recommend deep stops, specifically stopping halfway between max depth and the surface, and he observed the advantages of recompression theory, as well as the effectiveness of breathing pure oxygen once bent. So he was apparently so influential that these days, even till now, they say that CNS oxygen toxicity is termed the Paul Blurt effect. So coming from there, I guess we have to try to figure out how does this start get putting into, like, how do we put this information into modern diving? And in about the early 1900s, 1905 or so, John Scott Haldane was working with the Royal Navy trying to decrease instances of the bends. And so another one of these like really ethical things, he was experimenting on goats, and he determined that each tissue in the body absorbs and releases gases at different rates. And so it was at this point that he introduced the idea of tissue compartments and posited that each tissue compartment has a unique half-life. So of course, not to be outdone, in 1912, the U.S. Navy started working with a guy named George Stilson, and he was testing Haldane's work to see if U.S. divers could pass their limits of 18 meters or 60 feet. And by 1915, working with Stilson, they'd actually achieved depths of about 83 meters or 275 feet based on the results of that research. So the Navy then, of course, they published their own sets of decompression tables. And since then, there's been many revisions of tables and the introduction of computer algorithms to account for these factors. As a result, we see a significant increase in safety. So without the work of all these pioneers of diving, it would have been impossible for us to even consider being recreational tech divers. I think it's important to acknowledge that because there are only a very small amount of people who are truly professional tech divers. And then there's folks like me who have a day job, but just absolutely love diving and challenging themselves for whatever reasons they may have. So without that foundational work, though, it's likely none of us weekend warriors would be able to safely hurdle ourselves into the sea and make it back safely. So that's really worth kind of tipping your hat to.
Thanks for that. Yeah.
Thanks for that deep dive.
Thanks for that deep dive on that in-depth topic. I definitely can't wait to hear where it goes next. So that brings us to April. What do we got this week on Dive Girls Around the World?
I guess this is my second Dive Girls Around the World segment because last time we talked about Irene. But this week I'm talking about a local Halifax girl, which is kind of exciting. So Courtney Baumgartner, she started diving in 2015 while on holiday in Jamaica. And she instantly fell in love with the freedom of being underwater and the amazing creatures that were there to discover. And she made a really bold move, and she left her career in events and marketing and decided to take the plunge and go back to school and study marine biology, which then brought her to Halifax, to us, and to study at Dalhousie University, where she discovered a wonderful community of divers through working at Torpedo Ray's Scuba. She met the sea wolves and, of course, the sea foxes. And her goal is to ultimately work as a scientific diver in the field of marine research. And she couldn't be happier to be pursuing her dream alongside of some of the most incredible and passionate women in diving, which is awesome. And Courtney is, well, as all of you know, is awesome and such a fun person to be around. And I'm really excited to highlight her as my first local dive girl around the world. And you can find her on Instagram at Baumer25. So Baumer25.
Check her out and follow her on the old Instagram.
Yeah.
And see what she's diving this week.
I also feel like in my Dive Girls Around the World segment, this is a good time to say it, but it is Stacy Moser's 1-year scuba anniversary today. So congrats to Stacy.
Way to go, yep. Stacy.
Happy anniversary.
Happy scubaversary.
Scubaversary. I like it.
Yeah.
What do you get for a 1-year scubaversary?
Aren't you supposed to go scuba diving naked or something on your...
No, that's 100.
That's 100, is it?
That's okay. 100 dives you go naked, okay. Which that's I didn't harder. Do. So
that's a harder thing to do in cold water.
Yeah, Sonia did it in like a onesie, which is probably better.
Seems brave no matter what you wear.
Here. Anyhow, happy anniversary, anyway. Stacy.
cold water is not an excuse.
So you did your 100th cold water dive naked, Nick?
I didn't even know that was a thing until recently, so I don't know what rock I've been hiding under all these years.
All right, okay, enough of that. Let's just get back to the fact that doesn't Courtney actually do some serious research on whales
or something to this effect?
I think that could be some pretty interesting stuff, especially around here. I think I'm going to have to ask her the next time I see her if it's like anything to do with the whale research that we're seeing where the right whales were getting damaged and or hurt by being in shipping lanes and stuff. But whatever it is, the fact that you're getting to work with those creatures in the ocean at some point would be incredible. So yeah, look forward to hearing more from her.
Yeah, she would actually be an awesome guest to have on the show sometime.
I think she's definitely on our prospect sheet. We'll have to work on that and get her on the show.
Absolutely.
Well, that does it, everybody, for this week's episode. I want to thank Dr. Lauren Smith for joining us on the show, and thanks to Nick for doing that interview.
It's a pleasure.
Weren't you going to find something that you were going to say that wasn't just a pleasure? I think I heard you say that on the last episode.
It's a minor inconvenience, but...
There you go.
Put that, you know, that it's tough work, but somebody's going to do it.
There you go. And Amit, thanks for being here.
Well, you know, it's a minor inconvenience, but somebody's got to do it, so I'm here.
And April, thanks for being here as well.
I was waiting for you to say thanks. I thought you were just going to say, and April.
No, I know better than not thank you.
Yep, thanks for thanking me. Thanks
You're
for
welcome.
Having me.
You're welcome.
Lots of thanks. Very thankful tonight.
Well, you can follow the show on Instagram and Facebook with @diveinthepodcast. Our email is diveinthepodcast@gmail.com. You can also visit our website, www.diveinpod.com. On there, you can send us a voice message and find links to all of our past episodes. On social media, you can follow me @idiveok. April's @aprilweichert. Nick Winkler is @NicholasWinklerPhotography. You can find links to everything we've mentioned on today's episode in the show notes on our website, diveinpod.com. Join us next week for another amazing episode of Dive In the Podcast. This week's episode is brought to you by our sponsor, Torpedo Ray Scuba. Head over to your favorite podcast app to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. It's very much appreciated. Thanks for listening.
How are the frogs, Justin?
Actually, Pam, my partner, says that she's only seen two frogs at any one time recently. She's worried that we might be missing a frog.
What did it do? Jump out of the tank and run away?
Well, you never know. Fish tanks are crazy. The fish just literally disappear.
What? So. Well, that was like your suicidal clownfish.
And printer.
and 3D printer. Yes, I have really poor set of things around me, I guess.
They need to listen to last week's episode.
They need to listen. They need to take up diving. They need to be free diving. That clownfish and that 3D printer need to free dive more often.
Yep. So what? We might be down to two African dwarf frogs?
It's true. We might be. I've got to do some tank maintenance soon, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Let us know next week if there is a froggy funeral on the go.
All right. Well, I don't know if everybody will be able to wait an entire week to find out the answer to this dilemma, but I will report back as soon as I know.
It's going to be riveting. I can't wait.
Riveting. It'll be
riveting.
Riveting. okay. I beat you to it, Justin.